session number 4602, reel number 1.
Brigadier Sherman, reel 1. Where were you educated?
I went to Chapman College, and I was there from 1925 to 1929. I come from a service family, mainly naval. My third name is Collingwood, and I am a direct descendant of the Admiral, and I'm also connected to the American General. And we really stem from the branch of the Sherman family that was down in Devon, that originated in Suffolk. While at Cheltenham, I wanted to go into the Navy to follow in my father's footsteps, but I failed the medical test on my eyesight, and I carried on the normal engineering syllabus at Cheltenham, the military engineering syllabus they called it, and when I reached the age of about 16, in fact after I had got my school certificate, my father said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be an engineer." And he, being a naval engineer, said, "Well, you'll go into the Royal Engineers." And so I went to Woolwich, not realising that the Royal Engineers were not the sort of engineers that I was talking about. However, I went to Woolwich, and while there, I took mechanical and engineering science as an option extra, and realising that I would not be able to get one of the limited vacancies into the Royal Engineers, I wasn't half clever enough for that, I opted to go to the Royal Tank Corps, as it was then, really for technical employment, as they used to run their own workshops, their own technical side in those days. And I was lucky enough to be given the one commission a year from the Royal Military Academy Woolwich into the Royal Tank Corps. And because I came from Woolwich, it gave me seniority over the Sandhurst cadets, which in those days meant a great deal because promotion was on vacancy and not on time. And so one was able to see that by being at the top of the batch, just below the university so candidates, I had a far better chance of fairly early or a reasonably earlier promotion compared to Sandhurst people. I was duly commissioned in 1931 into the Royal Tank Corps and did my young officer training at Bovington, Military College of Science at Woolwich, and at Lulworth for the gunnery course. Because of my engineering training, I got a distinguished both at the Military College of Science and at the Tank Corps Gunnery School at Lulworth. And when I joined my regiment, I was appointed the technical adjutant. No, I assisted the technical adjutant. Now, one normally served approximately 2 years in a regiment in the UK, and you were then drafted or trooped out either to India or to Egypt. Those who were at the top of the batch of young officers were normally selected for the one battalion that was in Egypt, and everybody else went to India. For some reason, I don't really know, I didn't want to go to India, although my family have enormous connections in India, and always have had. But I didn't want to go to India, and so I was hoping that I would get the one vacancy for Egypt. I didn't. That went to one of the university entrants, and so feeling somewhat frustrated and not desirous of going to India, I applied for secondment to the Colonial Office to go to the Iraq levies, where there was a post being advertised, I think to teach machine gunnery or something. I can't remember exactly. Anyhow, the then brigadier of the 1st Armoured Brigade, on whose staff I was serving, sent for me one day and said, "I see you have volunteered to go to the Iraq levies. I'm not very keen that you should go there, but I would like you to go to the Transjordan Front Force. Would you like to go to Transjordan?" Whereupon I said, "Where is that?" And was told to go and look up on the Atlas and find out. I decided to go. I was interviewed by the Colonial Office, by the War Office. I was told exactly what to say by all the powers that be to make sure I got the job, because they wanted me to have it and not one of the other 50 that were on the waiting list.
What sort of things did you have to say?
One of the people I had to interview in the Colonial Office would ask me, "What courses have you done?" And the chap who was sort of briefing me on this before I ever had this interview would say, "And you've got to say this. What qualifications did you get? You have got to say very distinguished."
What sort of things had you been hearing about the Transjordan Frontier Force before the interviews?
Very little indeed, except that I was being required to join a mechanized squadron that had recently been converted from a camel squadron to a mechanized squadron. Mechanized infantry, I think you'd call it in the military terms. And that they wanted me to go out to train not only the Arab officers and the Arab rank and file, but also the older generation of British officer who had no knowledge of this, having been transferred from camels or cavalry of the Palestine Gendarmerie. We were somewhat resented by these people. They were known as scorpions, and they used to object rather to the arrival of these young upstarts from Sandhurst and Woolwich to tell them what to do.
How long after you heard that you got in did you leave England?
I was asked to go in July and I sailed in November.
Did you take any special preparations before you left England? Did
None
you buy
at all.
A special uniform?
No, that was all provided out there. When I arrived there, I can't even recall taking my British Army uniform, but I expect I did. But we knew we were going to be completely re-equipped on arrival at Sirka, where there was an Indian tailor. First thing you did after meeting the adjutant, probably the very next morning, was to go down and be measured up for all your kit. You then went down to the quartermaster stores where you were issued with the grey shirt and cummerbund and calpack and these sort of items that were so common to everybody.
How did you get out to Transjordan?
I was sent out by the Colonial Office, first class on P&O to Portside. The ship was the Kaiser Hind, I think at the bottom of the sea. In fact, I think it was the bottom of the sea before the war even broke out. And from Portside, I had to go down to Kantara, and then I came up on the train on my own to Jerusalem. And at Jerusalem, I was met by, strangely enough, an Arab Legion officer who was on loan to the Transjordan Frontier. No, he was seconded to the Transjordan Front Force to learn how to mechanize the Arab Legion. We sort of drove up from Jerusalem to Sirka.
This was the first time you'd been in the Middle East?
The end of November. First time I'd ever been abroad.
What was your impression of Port Said when you arrived there?
I wasn't there really long. I was met by, it was a representative of Grindley's Bank, because I happened to have my account there, and they were dealing with all my shipping arrangements. I think I was only there about a couple of hours before I had to get on a train and go down to Kantara. In fact, the journey was very easy. I landed at about 10 in the morning at Portside, and I was in Jerusalem by 11 o'clock the next morning. We slept on the train, which was not a very good experience. My first experience of driving across the desert in a very old Turkish train, having a sleeper and waking up being covered in sand and dust and everything was foul. I tasted it. And so that was my first impression. It wasn't until you got to about Gaza area that you began to see greenery again.
Now, how did you get to Zirka?
By car from Jerusalem.
And what was the road like then?
Oh, dreadful. It was all right down to Jericho on the Palestine side of the Jordan, because that had been tarmacked. Or it had been tarmacked for, I think I remember, about half its distance. But even the part which had not been tarmacked was not a bad road. It was when we crossed the Jordan that we were really travelling on a pretty primitive sort of road up through a salt. And in the wadi there, we passed some of the big Turkish guns that had been spiked on the Turkish retreat in the First War, lying in the bottom of the wadi. They used to be a great landmark for years. Went up to Salt, and then from Salt onwards, I think the tarmac road, there was a short bit of tarmac from just outside Amman, which was then a very small town indeed, nothing to what it looks like now. We went through Amman and out to Zirka. We left Jerusalem at... Well, we had lunch in the King David, I remember. It was a big police lunch I had to join for some reason or other. And we then left about 3 o'clock, and we were in Zirka by about 8 in the evening, so that as it's only a matter of 80 miles, you can see what sort of a road it was. But I'm not sure it was even 80, it may only be 50. But it was a very rough journey and very cold.
What happened when you arrived in Zirka?
In Zirka I was met by the adjutant, and I stayed in his bungalow with him while I was being introduced. He was an old tank corps friend of mine anyhow, and he told me all the ropes, and I was introduced to my Arab servant, or my Arab batman, and who was then going to be my batman for as long as I could think. In fact, I didn't keep him very long in the end, but he was to be my batman for as long as he was in the force. I suppose I spent about a week in Zirka, living with the adjutant, I was there all over Christmas. I was there over Christmas. And one normally had one's own bungalow, and so you had to furnish these places. They were quite unfurnished. There was nothing in them at all. They were wooden bungalows with tin roofs, quite large. Unless you were single living in the mess in Zirka, but when you went down to Marne, you had your own bungalow. And I had to buy second-hand furniture from a married officer's family who were going home. After Christmas, I was introduced to my company commander, as he was then called. They hadn't then been redesignated squadrons. I was introduced to my company commander, who subsequently became my father-in-law, and he and his wife had been organising the High Commissioner for Palestine's Christmas camp at Aqaba, and had just come back from there, and we drove down to Marne together, a distance of 108 miles across the desert, which took us about 10 hours.
What was the journey like?
Cold. It was the Odessa at that time of year always is very cold, particularly at night, of course. It was raining hard when we left. It got much better when we once we were had left Amman behind us and we were in the desert proper. Although the desert is fairly high, it's about 4,000 feet plateau. Once you're in the desert, the rain eases off frequently. You can see it all around you, around the hills of Moab and that sort of thing, but it doesn't actually fall in the desert very much. But it was cold, and we got down to Marn, and there I met my future mother-in-law, still alive, age 94, and they gave me a meal in their bungalow, and then I was taken across to my own bungalow in Marn camp. I was the only other British officer there.
What was the bungalow like?
It had, in fact, it was called the officer's mess. There were two bungalows, but there was only at that time one British officer there. The other officer who had joined me was still down at Aqaba clearing up the camp, Leachy's camp. But you had a bungalow on either side of what was called an officer's mess, which was really a kitchen, a dining room, and a sort of anteroom, quite small. We, in our sort of bungalows, also had a bedroom and a sitting room and our own bathrooms and things. But the mess itself had a guest room where we could accommodate people that we used to rescue after their visit to Petra when they broke down and that sort of thing. And it was a little compound of its own, and I think from my point of view, going to Marn to start off with was a very good thing because I was so much on my own, no knowledge of Arabic, no knowledge of Arabs, in fact, really, that I was able to concentrate on learning the language from my Arab officers and really sort of getting on with finding out all about them. In fact, my senior Arab officer was an ex-Turkish officer with Turkish war medals and almost old enough to be my father anyhow. And it was a very good introduction to the front force, and I'm sure by going down there on my own and being left on my own at the age of 24 was a tremendous experience and really made me have to do things for myself.
Did you meet your Arab officers straight away?
I met my Arab officers almost at once. One of them was a comparatively young Christian Arab from Jaffa, who'd been educated at the American University of Beirut. His knowledge of English was absolutely perfect. In fact, he would rather write in English than in Arabic, and he became a great friend until he died. And but he was very insistent that I should never talk English unless I absolutely had to in front of the troops. And in fact, he would never let me talk English to him except in bits and pieces when I was totally stumped for a word. And he taught me my Arabic. And it was due to his teaching that I eventually passed the army interpretership examination in Arabic in Egypt. I had to take it in Egypt, I think. No, I didn't. I took it in Jerusalem, part of it, and I had to take the Viva Voce in Egypt for some reason. And it was not normal for the seconded officers necessarily to learn Arabic to that extent. You had to pass a colloquial examination within 6 months in order to be confirmed in your secondment, which was normally for 4 years with a break after two, to go home and leave. If you didn't pass the colloquial examination, then in theory you should have been sent home. I can't recall anybody ever being sent home. I think the standard of pass was probably pretty low, but that was one of the conditions of service. If, however, you were learning Arabic in the way I was learning it, which is to learn to read and write it, and the grammar and everything else, then you were excused the colloquial examination, because they realized that in due course you'd have a far better knowledge of Arabic than if you'd just taken the colloquial.
What was your first impression of the local troops themselves?
Extremely keen. Their basic education was much below that of a British other rank. But we had our own education system for the Frontier Force officers, so many of them were being made literate in their own language, which they were not previously when they joined. The NCOs were all illiterate and very keen. Very few of them understood any English. So one relied on one's local officers to translate or interpret for you very often some of the technical terms you had to use. But in the main, the words of command, the technical words, the technical things on gunnery and driving and maintenance were either bastardized Turkish words or English. What? My main job was to convert them from being riflemen carried on a truck or a troop carrier into troopers who were able to fire machine guns on the move from new vehicles that we were designing. The mechanized company, as it was then called, then had an organization of two half companies, and each of the half companies was commanded by a British officer. It had two Arab officers, and all the rest were Arab. All the soldiers were Arab. We had the assistance of one British warrant officer, who, so far as I was concerned, was mainly involved in the repair and maintenance of vehicles. He was not a instructor in gunnery in the sense that I was. In fact, I don't think he had any knowledge of gunnery at all. There was a British warrant officer armourer, but he was a Zerka, and he only used to pay a visit down to Marne about once a quarter. He, of course, had his own staff of Arab armourers who were very good craftsmen. Our main role down in Marne was really carrying on what we were doing before, but in a far more mobile state. By having these new vehicles, we were able to get out to the farthermost corners of the frontier as we knew it, much more readily than they had previously when they were on camels, and it was probably a 3 or 4 day ride to the furthermost tip, known as ZZ1.
What were the new vehicles?
We were, at that time, being advised by the Royal Air Force, because we were being administered by them. And in order to ease the logistic problems, we were expected to have the same sort of vehicles that the Royal Air Force had. So we had six-wheeled Crossley troop carriers, terrible little things, designed about 1923, which were an RAF vehicle. and they were just converting to commas, which were then a part of the roots group. And so our new vehicles were all to be on, were all to be commas. In fact, the first consignment of these vehicles had arrived about 6 months before I had. They were quite a good vehicle for that work, but later on, when we, when I had more experience as to what was required, and I'd moved from being a half company commander down in Marne of a mechanized company and had taken over the workshops, I realized that we could do far better by, unfortunately, going to American vehicles, which were firstly more readily available, and the and particularly people like General Motors were far more prepared to give us what we wanted rather than being told to take what they had.
How well did the local soldiers adapt to the new equipment?
So far as the weapons were concerned, they adapted extremely well, because they enjoyed that sort of thing very much. They were very competitive. They sort of inter-troop and inter-section competitions were their lifeblood. So far as the driving and maintenance was concerned, one was had a long way to go, but we were able to teach them how to drive and how to do simple maintenance. But in the main, one relied upon the British Warrant Officer, who was down there with a small workshop team that was mainly comprised of technicians recruited in Palestine who could be Jewish, Hungarian, Romanian, any nationality you like, but they were not Arab.
Were you all living in the same camp at this time?
We were living in the same camp. I think the British Warrant Officer had a very lonely existence, because he was not always accepted by the local officers, because he was in a very invidious position. He had he had no executive position with an Arab officer. He was not allowed to give an Arab officer an order. On the other hand, the Arab officer was not allowed to give him an order either. He was there purely as an advisor and as a technician. Because he wasn't a commissioned officer, he couldn't live with the British officers in the British officers' mess as such. And the one British Warrant Officer down in Marne, I think, had a pretty lonely existence. But he did have the advantage that there was almost invariably, but not always, but almost all the time, there was a half company of Royal Air Force armoured cars in Marne. They had their own camp, their own NAFI, and they were, of course, 100% British, and he was able to make his friends over there. But so far as friends were in the French force were concerned, when he was in Marne, he was a very lonely man. In Zurich, it was quite different. They had their own British Warrant Officers' mess, where all the British Warrant Officers lived. It was like a perfectly normal sort of British Army Sergeant's mess, run on those lines, and probably rather better lines, because they all had their own bungalows as well. They comprised people like the armourer, the chief clerk, the paymaster, the quartermaster sergeant, three riding instructors, or three workshops warrant officers. That was the hospital had one British warrant officer who was an RAMC man. I think that was about it, really. There were, I can't remember how many there were altogether. I think there must have been about nine of them. They were only expected to be in Marne for 6 months at a time. It was just they were sent down from Zirka, and they had a stint of 6 months on their own down there. They were very valuable people, and nearly all of them who remained after war was declared were commissioned and became normal British officers of the Transjordan Frontier Force and perfectly happily integrated into the system that had previously been held by regular British officers.
How long would the warrant officer normally serve in the Transjordan Frontier Force?
He had the same contract as we had, which was a 4-year one.
What sort of accommodation did the local troops have in Marne?
The normal type of British or barrack room. There was no difference. I think one of the major differences one has to remember about the rank and file of the Transjordan Frontier Force is that they were not rationed. We did not feed them. They fed themselves. They had to go down to the village and buy their own rice and sugar and flour and bread, and they entirely fed themselves. There was no such thing as other ranks dining room or anything like that. And even when we went out on a trek into the desert, they had to go down to the village and load up their own vehicle with sacks of flour and sugar, and they did all their own cooking in the desert. They were not rationed.